It is 8:30. We have with us live in the studios once again, Joff Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
Plenty to cover, so let's just dive right in.
Yeah. All right. Nice day out, by the way.
Oh, it's nice to finally have summer.
Yes.
All right.
Maybe that Al Gore is onto something. Anyway.
That's crazy. Lawsuits, locally lawsuits.
Yes, we were talking a few months ago about all the various neighborhood protests against the Parks Department for various top-down, often commercially driven decisions that Parks had been making under Superintendent Kim Bounds. And that had kind of faded from the headlines, and people may wonder whatever became of that. Well, it's about to go back into the news again. We had a hearing on the Occidental Park neighbors lawsuit against the city, a lawsuit that continued even though the various trees in Occidental Park, which caused such a stink back in March when they were cut down in February and March, the Occidental residents had filed suit to prevent that. They had won a stay, and then the court, at the request of the Parks Department, ordered them to put up $115,000 bail to cover what Parks claims was the cost of delaying the project. Well, the neighbors couldn't do that, of course, and so the project went ahead and the trees were cut down, but the lawsuit also went ahead. The neighbors wanting to pursue it just to, try and force environmental review in the future and a better decision-making process that wasn't quite so top-down and wasn't quite so commercially driven. That lawsuit had its hearing this past Monday, and then on Thursday the lawyers came back and each spent 90 minutes arguing the case. So we'll have a decision on that in a couple of weeks. Meanwhile, next Tuesday, and we'll talk about this in events at the end of the half hour, the Friends of Gaswork Park, their lawsuit, which prevented One Reel from having their Summer Nights concert series in Gasworks Park this summer, a decision that was completely sprung on the Wallingford neighborhood and again was done with no environmental review. And so Friends of Gaswork Park, which is supposed to be on the same side as the city when it comes to shepherding the park, is suing the city over the lack of environmental review. And they're quite explicitly trying to prevent the city and One Reel from having concerts at Gasworks in the future. They feel it's an inappropriate use of the park, and it's also inappropriate that the city is allocated $150,000 for infrastructure utility upgrades at the park that benefit a private concern, namely One Reel Concerts. So that hearing will be next Tuesday morning. A lot of the neighborhood leaders were actually also present this week when the City Council's Committee on Charter Amendments took public testimony on Monday, and then yesterday they met again to discuss the public testimony and hear from City Attorney Tom Carr. Peter Steinbrook chairs the committee, and he wants to put up to 12 different city charter amendments on the November ballot, which is almost as many as we've had since the current city charter was formed in 1946. Most of them are technical, but one is quite controversial. It's Charter Amendment Number 3, and what it would do is take the five department heads that don't currently have fixed terms, and off the top of my head, they're police, fire, personnel, fiscal accountability, and parks. Well, you'd expect a police to be the most controversial one, but it's not. It's Parks and Ken Bounds. He is a very close ally of Greg Nichols. He's been in office forever, going back to Norm Rice's days. And all the different neighborhood groups that are upset with him have been unable to do anything about it because Greg Nichols not only stands by him, but much of the commercially driven decision-making, it's believed, is actually coming from City Hall, and Bounds is simply doing their bidding. Well, what Steinbrook wants to do is force Bounds and the other department heads who now have indefinite terms of service appointed by the mayor to be reappointed by the mayor and confirmed by City Council every 4 years. So it would essentially give City Council a veto every 4 years over the continuation of problematic department heads like Ken Bounds. This is really kind of a departure for the current City Council because it's pretty much let Greg Nichols have his way for the past several years. But this is pretty much a direct challenge to his authority, and Nichols, of course, is very adamantly opposed to this. The hearings this week, all the various anti-Parks Department neighborhood activists were out to testify in favor of it. If it does go on the November ballot, and the decision for that will be taken by City Council on, I believe, July 21st, you're going to be hearing a lot more about this over the time between now and November, because it's very much a direct power struggle down at City Hall. We'll see how it turns out, whether the little guys win one for a change.
All right. And King County had a vote this week on voting.
Yes, they did. King County Council voted 5-4 along party lines. Of course, the Republicans are still convinced that King County elections is beset by massive fraud, and of course that the fraud all benefits the Democrats. The Democrats all voted in favor of all-male voting for King County. However, to allay the concerns of some of the many activists who have emerged to oppose all-male voting, they tried to put in a number of steps for accountability. They also want to replace Dean Logan, who has left as the head of King County Elections, and several other senior Elections Department officials whose offices now are vacant. And so it looks like, because of those new conditions, that the abolition of walk-in polling places and the going to all-male voting may not happen until 2008 or even 2009. So that's a fairly significant delay, and the delay is, I think, directly attributable to the not just the fact that the King County Republicans are opposed to it, because, let's face it, the King County Republicans don't have a whole lot of power in King County, but there's been a tremendous grassroots opposition to this that really transcends ideology. A lot of people who just don't like the idea that you don't have the option of going to a polling place in your neighborhood and voting.
All right. And of course, by all mail, we mean postal service as opposed to the gender, which,
yes,
you know,
exactly.
There are certain people would like to see all mail voting in the gender.
Yes, that's right. There were the repeal of the 20th Amendment or whatever it was.
Okay, moving along to national. Looks like the government would like to, if not already has, crack open everybody's bank accounts.
Yeah, this is a report that the New York Times had this week. And of course, we had Dick Cheney in the news this morning saying he was outraged that the media would report on something that is not only perfectly legal, but endangers the war on terrorism. And of course, we've heard all this before, just as we've heard before that, well, yes, the administration is violating the privacy rights of thousands of Americans, but they're only Americans with ties to Al-Qaeda. Where have we heard this before? And can we see some evidence of that, please? The New York Times report basically is that the Bush administration has been data mining through the financial records of what it says are thousands of Americans. That also was the initial report with NSA monitoring, as you will recall, both that it was people with ties to Al-Qaeda and that it only involved a few hundred or a few thousand Americans. And we later turned out to be a couple hundred million Americans, with the goal being a database that included all Americans. That's the direction this is going also. And if you remember, John Poindexter and his Total Information Awareness Program at the Pentagon in 2003, that was very controversial, when it first came to public light and was shot down because of the public outcry, the idea was to build a database that would track every electronic transaction of every American, every resident of this country. And frankly, it seems like that's exactly what the administration is doing. They're just doing it piece by piece by piece. And this is another component of it, is that if you do any kind of electronic record keeping by with your finances, which is to say, if you have a bank or savings and loan or credit union account anywhere, or you use an ATM, any of that kind of thing, or credit card, the government is paying attention to those financial records. It's a very scary kind of thing.
All right. And meanwhile, the FBI is getting involved in the private sector for their information.
Yes. This also came out this week, and it was a little bit less widely reported. It came out in congressional testimony that the FBI is using so-called data brokers, that is, private investigators who will, for a fee, track down information on you, private information, you know, your Social Security number, your address, your financial records, your you know, various accounts of yours and their standing and so forth. The FBI is using some of these folks, and the reason they're using them is fairly straightforward. Number one, they don't particularly have to obey the law. Some of their tactics for getting this information involve lying, misrepresentation, pretending to be you and calling up companies that you have an account with in order to get your information, that kind of thing. And the other thing, of course, is that they don't have to bother with anything like court oversight or warrants or anything like that. So at this point, the Bush administration is saying, oh, these were isolated cases, but it's an awful lot of isolated cases, and it's definitely something that warrants further investigation. But, you know, who's going to investigate the investigators? Once again, it's a problem.
All right. Well, you mentioned court oversight. The courts were busy this week.
Yeah. The Supreme Court issued a kind of a curious 5-4 decision. And, of course, you can guess who the swing votes in the five were. Yet another example of why Maria Cantwell should have filibustered against Samuel Alito. That basically said that the Clean Water Act cannot be used to cover the definition of wetlands and the environmental protection thereof unless the wetland or the low-lying watered area in question is adjacent to a navigable body of water. Now, anybody who knows anything about wetlands in marshy areas knows that it is not, in fact, often near a navigable body of water. Particularly if the, you know, in order to be navigable, you're defining it as having to be traversed by an aircraft carrier or something, which I'm sure is, you know, the next step in the court ruling. So that was one court ruling. However, there was also an interesting development in the court case this week of Jose Padilla, the American citizen who was first held for 3 years without charges and without access to lawyers or family or anybody else on the grounds that he was an enemy combatant, quote unquote. Last fall, the government abruptly, in order to try and head off the review of his case by the Supreme Court, abruptly went ahead and charged him and a couple of co-defendants in Miami with a very vague plot to be terrorists, basically. That's what the government said. The judge in that case this week came out and said that the government's case against Padilla was, quote, very light on facts, end quote, and ordered the government to produce more details of what this alleged plot was, or she would throw out the Padilla case, the case against Padilla and his co-defendants, which would be a remarkable outcome after all these years that and all the headlines that Padilla got for being the so-called dirty bomber, which is not part of any of these charges, that the charges against him may well not stand up in court at all.
All right. Moving along, the Pentagon has released a document this week, or they leaked a document?
Well, neither. Actually, it was kind of discovered through Freedom of Information process by an advocacy group. This is a document in which the Pentagon is classifying mental problems that that their soldiers have and how to respond to them. And one of the quote unquote mental disorders that it lists is homosexuality. Now, this is something, of course, that mental health professionals dropped about 40 or 50 years ago, was when they stopped considering homosexuality a mental disorder. But, you know, just in time for Pride Weekend, I guess it was considered a good idea to trot this out. And it also is pretty revealing in terms of how the Pentagon treats its don't ask, don't tell policy. The category of mental disorders that homosexuality is thrown in with includes mental retardation. It includes personality disorders such as schizophrenia, bipolar, and so forth. It really tells you a lot about that policy of benighted tolerance that currently exists in the military regarding gays, lesbians, bisexuals, and I don't even want to think about transgenders in the military. But that could be an amusing skit sometime, I think, maybe.
All right. Well, moving along, the ACLU is very busy these days.
Yeah, and they helped launch a lawsuit this week. They've done some amazing work in the past year or so. They seem to be virtually the only organization out there that's taken seriously the civil liberties violations of the Bush administration and trying to hold their feet to the fire. Congress certainly isn't doing it. State attorneys general certainly don't seem to be doing it, but the ACLU is trying their best. This week, they filed a lawsuit along with a number of Muslims and Arab Americans against the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security over the terrorist watch list that is maintained at airports and borders around and through and surrounding the United States. The claim basically is that terrorism watch list, which currently, at least as of 2005, numbers some 237,000 Americans, and as we've talked about in this program before, that number is dramatically up over 2004. Nobody knows how you get on the list. Nobody knows how you can get off the list, and so forth. Their lawsuit is basically on two basic threads. One of them is on behalf of plaintiffs who have the same last name as somebody on the watch list, or the same name period, who are routinely, every time they try and enter or leave the country, given the third degree, and they find it virtually impossible to get off the list. And a study last year, and doesn't say here who the study was by, but it went from December 2003 to January 2005, revealed that 42% of the calls to the screening center from security guards, concerned that they found somebody on the watch list, turned out to have the wrong person. So this is a fairly common occurrence within the terrorism watch list system. Then the second theme is people on the list who were wrongly categorized as dangerous, even though they aren't necessarily. They were just categorized as somebody that ought to be checked, but not somebody that you surround with 20 armed guards and hold in a windowless cell for the next week. And this again is something that a number of people have run into. And so that lawsuit on behalf of the ACLU, well, hopefully through the discovery process, we'll find out a little bit more about how people get on the list, who's monitoring that, what the definitions are, and so forth. Because it's a really alarming kind of development, because there's absolutely no due process involved with it at all.
All right. Well, you mentioned Congress isn't doing it. There was a couple things this week they aren't doing, and a bunch of other things they are doing.
Yeah. Henry Waxman, the congressman from California, according to Raw Story, which is a great national blog for folks who have never encountered it, Waxman produced a report showing that procurement spending in the Bush administration between 2000 and 2005 has gone up over $175 billion. It's 86% between 2000 and 2005. Federal contracts are the fastest growing part of the discretionary spending of Congress, according to the study. 118 different federal contracts worth $745 billion were found by government officials in that period to include significant waste, fraud, abuse, or mismanagement. And of course, that included all three of the major procurement efforts: the war in Iraq, Department of Homeland Security and Homeland Security efforts, and the Hurricane Katrina reconstruction. So a tremendous amount of fraud and abuse taking place. Same time this week, the CEO of Halliburton was reported to have sold his stock off in the last 3 years since he became the CEO of Halliburton. This, of course, being a successor to Dick Cheney. He's made $78 million on the transaction. One guy, just since the beginning of the war in Iraq. The New York Times, at the same time, had a report that the more than 90 former DHS or White House Department of Homeland Security officials are now working in the private sector. They're executives, consultants, or lobbyists for corporations that do business with the Homeland Security apparatus. So the revolving door is another major source of corruption on this. What is Congress doing about this? Well, I'll tell you what they're doing. The House this week, as part of a defense appropriations bill, spending some... what's the total here? It was enormous, as I recall, and I didn't write it down. But it's an enormous defense appropriations bill, of which there's another. There was an amendment offered that would actually make it illegal to defraud the federal government on procurement. And of course, it went down. It went down on a primarily party line vote. But at the same time, there was also a vote in the Senate on their version of the Defense Appropriations Bill for something called the Leadership and Accountability and Contracting Act of 2006. That was in the Senate, I'm sorry, not the House. 55-43 vote, a straight party line. The House was the one that voted on making it illegal to contravene the FISA Act. It was an attempt to bring accountability to the NSA spying scandal, and that went down also on a party line vote. But if you think about this for a moment, what the House vote was is to enforce the law. what the Democrats in the House wanted was to make it illegal to do something that is already on the books as being illegal. And House Republicans voted it down. They voted in favor of breaking the law, which is really kind of remarkable.
All right. And also tied to the House this week, there was a decision on the voting and minimum wage.
Oh, yes. Senate voted this week on the minimum wage. The Democrats had a proposal. The Republicans voted it down. And then the Republicans had a proposal for a much lower minimum wage increase that had some strings attached. And the Democrats were opposed and some Republicans opposed. So they voted that down also. Meanwhile, in the House, House Republican leaders have canceled a vote on the extension of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. Voting rights are now considered too controversial, partially because of objections from southern states that feel there's no longer any problem with discrimination in the South. Just having come from the South a couple, 3 weeks ago, I can assure you that's not true. In fact, it's not really true anywhere in this country. And at the same time, there's also objections because one of the requirements of the 1965 Civil Rights Act and subsequent court decisions is for bilingual ballots in areas where there's a substantial number of non-English speaking voters. And of course, the illegal immigrant lobby is all up in arms about this. They want ballots only in English, even though people who vote are by definition citizens of the United States. Go figure. But that forced House Republican leaders to cancel a vote on extending the Voting Rights Act. So that may be in some jeopardy, too.
All right, jumping to international, Iraq.
A lot happened in Iraq this week, or Iraq this week, either one. A state of emergency declared in Baghdad yesterday because of insurgent attacks, both near the Green Zone and in another part of town. So much for the insurgency dying at the end of Zarqawi's death. Of course, Cheney coming out and saying that his comment last year that the insurgency was in its last throes is a remark that he stands by. This, even though the U.S. ambassador to Iraq, a memo of his on June 6th to the White House, laid out really just how close to pure disintegration the situation in Iraq is. That got a fair amount of attention, certainly among progressive media, but what did not get attention was that the memo relies almost entirely on anecdotal evidence. You know, an Iraqi who works in the Green Zone told us that. An Iraqi whose cousin was threatened by insurgents for wearing short pants. It's all anecdotal stuff. It's like, if this is the best information that the U.S. government and the U.S. embassy has on what's going on in Iraq, they have no clue what's actually going on in the country. They're not even reading blogs from Iraq by Iraqis. I mean, they just don't seem to have any idea what's actually happening in the country. And yet, even so, just from this anecdotal information, the ambassador has a far better idea of what's going on than the, you know, rose-colored pronouncements from the White House and Dick Cheney's insistence on the insurgency being in its last throes would indicate. Several other developments, of course, good friend Lieutenant Colonel Watada refused deployment to Iraq this week. There will be events this week to show solidarity with him. We have Rick Santorum, the embattled senator from Pennsylvania, who is badly losing his re-election campaign because voters in Pennsylvania have figured out that the man's a right-wing loon, trotted out a claim on the Senate floor this week that the United States has found its weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. What he was referring to was an Army National Ground Intelligence Center report that basically recycles some of the same observations from a 2004 report, which in turn was describing chemical weapons that were manufactured and stored in Iraq prior to the Gulf War in 1991. And this is being trotted out by Santorum as evidence that, we went to war to find this stuff, which, of course, is, not only a revision of history, but factual nonsense. A couple of different scandals for war crimes in Iraq made it into the crime blog, or rather crime log this week. Seven Marines and one sailor were charged with the murder of an Iraqi man in the town of Hadalia on April 26th, and the Army has charged three soldiers with murder the murder of three Iraqis who were in custody at the time of their deaths, and with obstructing justice when the army tried to investigate the incident. This happened at a place called Tharthar Canal in northern Salahuddin province. And finally, just as a note, there is Japan also is withdrawing its last 600 troops out of Iraq by the end of the year. That was announced this week also as the coalition of the willing shrinks a little bit further. There's been this trope the last couple of weeks as Congress has debated their various bogus Iraq resolutions that the Democrats dare not oppose the war too vividly because they will offend potential voters come November. And this is not being put out just by pundits. It's being put out by journalists. And it's really pretty disturbing because every reasonable poll that's been taken on the issue in the last several months has shown 60% or more of Americans wanting immediate or very soon withdrawal of troops from Iran. This is not only a majority, but a supermajority position, a majority that is considered a mandate when it happens in presidential elections and a landslide. Not only are Republicans not responding to this, but Democratic leaders aren't also. And that's the story that media should be reporting, not that Democrats are risking something by opposing the war.
From Iraq. Very briefly, unfortunately, Palestine-Israel.
Yeah, a couple things this week. Hamas, and this story should have gotten a lot more attention, recognized Israel's right to exist as a way of trying to mitigate the siege of Palestine that's been happening the last couple of months. They also said that they would support a negotiated two-state settlement, the emphasis being on negotiated there because, of course, Olmert, the Israeli prime minister, has floated the idea of unilateral withdrawal from the West Bank, which would be on Israel's terms and essentially create permanent Bantustans for Palestine that are not a viable second state. And Olmert also came out with a remarkable story this week that the lives of Palestinians when civilian lives were lost were, it was kind of tragic, yeah, but that Israeli lives were even more important, quote, that's a direct Palestinian, than lives of Palestinians. And that's a kind of racist statement that, people in Israel and people in the United States when it comes to Iraqis or, for that matter, Palestinians think all the time, but they rarely have the nerve to say it out loud. And the fact that it is being said out loud says a lot about how we value the other in a time of war.
And quickly, events.
Several events today and going on for the next several days of the Vancouver Global Peace Forum happening up in Vancouver, BC. A lot of international peace and anti-war leaders and really wonderful resources up there for people who are interested. Today, from noon until 2 p.m., there will be bannering for Lieutenant Watada and Specialist Suzanne Swift, both of whom are resisting deployment to Iraq. That'll be at Exit 119 off I-5, the Fort Lewis entrance. And there will also be a bannering and rally from 4 to 6 p.m. on Tuesday evening. Same place, same issue. Gay Pride. There's two Pride marches and parades this year. There's the one that has been held every year that moved to Seattle Center. Will be 11 o'clock Sunday. The march leaves from Westlake, and folks who didn't want it to move it from Capitol Hill, that process of deciding the move was very top-down, didn't involve a lot of people in the GLBT community. So there will be a second march this year being led by the Dykes on Bikes, and that will be 5 p.m. tonight from Broadway and Pine. And then finally, on Tuesday morning, the 27th, the Friends of Gasworks Park lawsuit will be heard at 9:30 a.m. That'll be in the King County Courthouse with Judge Dean Lum, and they're encouraging people to come down and support them.
Talking as we do every week with Jav Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State comes out every couple weeks. It's a free publication of news, local, national, international, humor, opinion, more opinion, maybe a little bit more opinion. You can find it anywhere you get free and free publications, bookstores, cafes, King County Library System, wherever you want. It's also on the web at www.eatthestate.org. And if you have comments, tips, feedback, you want to volunteer, you want to send us money, all those are good things. And we can always use any of those things. Give us a call. Our voicemail is area code 206-719-6947.